Blue light, it's like a blue light special. There we go. We're going to open the Education Committee today, March 28, 2017. Thank you all for being here. And we're just going to kind of go down our agenda today. So we will start with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 196. And with that, we'll hear a short explanation from our administrator. And good, Senator Devenbrough is here.
Chair Rowland, members of the committee, Senate Bill 196 requires the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to review insurance policies adopted by institutions of higher education to determine whether benefits received by part-time faculty members take into account the aggregate total of hours worked at two or more public institutions of higher education.
And I was going to say before we get started, and thank you, Senator Devenbrough, for being here, we're going to try to keep people limited. First speaker about this gets a little bit longer, but after that we'll keep it down to like 2 minutes so that we can get through, because we've got like four bills that all have people here that want to testify, so we want to make sure we get to all those. So with that, I'm sorry I came a little late. Senator Devenbrough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Michael Devenbrough, senator from District 23, that's Northeast and Southeast Portland, very pleased to come before you with Senate Bill 196. Colleagues, as many of you know, most of you know, the face of employment in higher education has changed dramatically over the years, to the point that now most of the courses at our colleges and a large proportion of our courses at our universities are taught not by full-time faculty but by part-time faculty. The use of part-time faculty in its original form was supposed to be an opportunity to have people who are working professionals come in and share their expertise with students. But over the years, as a result of budget crunch after budget crunch, more of the teaching has moved over to part-timers who are paid much less and who in many cases don't receive any benefits. Through efforts that occurred in the early 90s, part-timers who taught at multiple institutions, and I should just kind of footnote that we have many part-time faculty who are actually teaching more than full-timers. It's just that their work is spread out over multiple institutions. And so, you know, in the early 90s, we made it possible for them to pool their hours across the institutions that they taught to become eligible for retirement benefits. And that began in the early 90s. In 2009, my first session, we passed House Bill 2557, which allowed those who were eligible for the PERS benefits to also be eligible for OEB health benefits. But on a self-pay basis, so they could buy into OEB. At the time, this was an important benefit, even though it was, you know, for many prohibitively expensive, but it at least gave them access to decent health care. But over the years, the you know, the cost of coverage has remained prohibitively expensive. So we've been working on this for a couple of sessions now. In 2015, we passed legislation that directed the HEC to study this issue and to come up with some recommendations, which they did do. And the bill that's before you today, Senate Bill 196, is following the first option that they provided for us, which would it would essentially create a fund that would that part-timers could have access to. In our original conception, each institution would be individually responsible for their share of the employee's health care for those who you know, who reach that threshold. So, you know, if they were teaching 50% at Portland Community College and 50% at Portland State, those two institutions would, you know, pay their equal share. We heard from the universities that that would be really difficult to administer and be hard on them. And so the work group recommended rather that the legislature should set up a pool of dollars that those employees who qualified by meeting the PERS standard of, you know, working enough through their pooled hours that they would qualify for health benefits, that they could then draw from this fund. And that's essentially what Senate Bill 196 does. There are further amendments that need to be made for this bill. I should tell you one that would clarify that in its current form, the HEC has responsibility for overseeing this program. That's not the intent. The intent is that it be very automatic through the OEB, and we don't really need the HEC to oversee that. That's something they don't really have the equipment to do. So, you know, if we can get that cleaned up, I think this bill will be ready to be sent down to Ways and Means. I'm going to end there. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have about the bill. But in terms of the need, I think you will hear that from the people who are behind me, you know, I think who will speak very eloquently of the situation that part-time faculty face. I can't overstate the good work that part-timers do. Our universities, our colleges could not function. And I think the university and college presidents would be the first to agree with me that their institutions could not function if it weren't for the sacrifices of part-time faculty. But we can only ask so much from these good people, from these good professionals. And Senate Bill 196 will be a step in making it easier for them to live their lives.
So did you want to speak to 206 as well?
No.
Okay. I was going to open that if you needed to.
Yeah. No.
Thanks.
Am I on that? Good. I mean, I'm happy to speak on it, but I know nothing about it.
That's good. Thank you. Okay. I was looking real quick to find, but you are not. I just wanted to make sure if you wanted that I gave you the opportunity. Okay. Any questions of the senator? Thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
So next, we're going to have Marta Kaneka. I hope I got that close. Martha Bailey and Cahill Zanozzi. Come on up. Oh, there's three chairs, so you can all have one of your own. And as soon as you get there, you can get started.
Chairman Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Marta Kunecka. I work as an adjunct philosophy professor at Oregon State University, Shimikita Community College, and Lynn Benton Community College, both in Albany and in Benton Center in Corvallis. I hold a PhD in philosophy and have over a decade of experience as an educator in Oregon and abroad. I want to urge you to support SB 196 to address the state's increasing reliance on part-time faculty working at multiple institutions of higher education and the lack of access to affordable healthcare for those part-time faculty. I came to the United States 10 years ago to complete my doctoral research, and I've worked in education in Oregon ever since. In the meantime, I have become a single parent and a homeowner, and I decided to make this enchanting and peaceful state home for me and for my daughter, a home where she will acquire her own education over the years. Because of this decision and because the state has few tenure-track positions available, I'm confined to working as an adjunct professor. I love teaching, and I'm fortunate to teach in Oregon. But the system currently in place presents several big challenges, one of them being the healthcare issue. At this time, I do not receive healthcare insurance benefits like other full-time faculty, even though between all of my positions, I work more than full-time, 1.5 to 1.75 full-time equivalent each term. My current yearly income puts me in the gap between making too much money to qualify for state insurance and yet not making enough to cover my health insurance costs with increasing premiums each year out of my own pocket. Each day, after dropping my daughter off to school, I commute back and forth among four different campuses. The time I spend commuting every week amounts to another 0.25 FTE, full-time equivalent, that I'm not paid for. I often ask myself whether the extra effort is worth it, and I always come to the same conclusion. It is worth it because I'm educating young people. I have acquaintances who receive state subsidies, including full healthcare coverage, while not working the long hours that I do. They work in industries other than education, which do not require constant availability and attention, and in positions that do not address the intellectual needs of young Oregonians. Hearing these stories, I'm often confronted with the thought of either leaving academia for an alternate field or of working less in order to ensure more security for myself and my daughter. That is, contributing less while receiving more state benefits. But this is not a valid option for me. Teaching is my passion. I want to continue teaching and contributing to the betterment of our communities. I am committed and a valued professor, and I care deeply about increasing philosophical awareness and reinforcing critical thinking skills for young Oregonians to ensure that those who graduate from our colleges are informed, educated, and equipped to participate in the commercial, civic, and political life of the state. But the fact remains, none of my workplaces offer the healthcare benefits I need.
Thank you. And if you have written testimony, make sure you don't need to read it all. Just
okay. I will just have my closing statement. We will continue taking care of our students. Please take care of us. And please support the bill.
Thank you very much. And we'll put the timer on this time, I think, so you can see actually how much time.
Thank you. Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name's Martha Bailey. I live in Tualatin, Oregon, and I am testifying in favor of Senate Bill 196. I've been a part-time faculty member at Portland Community College and at Clackamas Community College since 2004. I teach also philosophy and religious studies. And when I started, I had no access to health insurance through the schools. It didn't matter. I had a husband who was employed in private industry, and we had great health insurance. And so even though in 2008 PCC started offering employer-paid coverage and I was eligible, I opted out. However, in 2014, very unexpectedly, my husband lost his job. And he, in the interim, had a number of medical issues, including heart surgery, needed to be covered. While COBRA was available through his previous employer, it was prohibitively expensive. Fortunately, because I was eligible, I was able to opt in to health insurance at the point that we needed it and to cover my family. My husband returned to work, but he is now a contract employee working year to year. And we determined that under that situation, it was best for me to continue with the insurance through PCC. Last year, however, we had the unexpected situation of the drop in enrollment. And so while I had a full class at Clackamas, Clackamas was not offering any kind of health insurance except for some reimbursement. I needed to have classes at PCC, and so I taught several classes at tutor rate, which is essentially 40% pay for teaching the class, in order to qualify to have health coverage during this current year. And I have many colleagues who have similar situations, so thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Honorable Chairperson, distinguished senators, greetings to you. We would very much appreciate the opportunity to speak to you, and I know that we have limited couple of minutes, so I ask for your indulgence if I just go slightly over so I can communicate to you the heartfelt communication that I have to share with you. My name is Khalil Zunuzi. Khalil means friend, and Zunuzi means to start life again. Like every day is the beginning of life, and I have a reason for saying that. I'm speaking on behalf of the PSU Faculty Association that represents, in aggregate, 1,500 part-time or adjunct faculty during each year. And I hope that you would look at our bill with a favorable eye and favorable thought. I speak as an example of any adjunct faculty with a 33-year-plus history at Portland State and 28 years plus at PCC concurrently. And I voluntarily serve and have served on many faculties, many commissions, many task forces in our state. And I guess you would ask me why. Why is it that you continue doing what you do? It is not because of the high level of salary that adjunct faculty receive. It is not because of the health insurance benefit that I receive. More than anything, the fact of the matter is that I, as an example, pay over $1,300 a month for my health insurance for myself and my wife, which plus the copay and other expenses go way beyond that. We can teach only two classes simply because if we creep over the 0.50 or half an allot load for a part-time faculty at the institution, you become eligible for benefits. So that's why it's tough. So I continue, ladies and gentlemen, because I love doing what I do. I continue because I am devoted. I continue when I remember those beautiful eyes sitting in the classroom across from the table, listening with hungry and thirsty eyes to learn. And it is important to realize that if I ask you to perhaps open your hearts and your mind and think that that class could be a class that your son, your daughter, your loved one, your grandchildren are sitting, listening to that part-time or adjunct faculty to teach. And that is an important issue because the quality of education that are provided by the part-time faculty is incomparable in many ways. And it is important to realize that majority of our part-time faculty, as has been stated, do serve their university and colleges without receiving appropriate benefits, which they should be entitled to. Just quickly, some of the statistics, ladies and gentlemen, if you look at fall 2016, our 10-year faculty covered 30% of the institution's faculty member. Fixed-term appointment were 258, which is 16%. Adjunct faculty made up 47% of the 1,595. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much. And we have one more panel on this bill. And then just so other people know from the other group, there's another group of people on this page who have said we'll come in afterward if we have more time. So I really want to say that I appreciate that to all the people. And I'm willing to stay here longer to make sure that testimony is there. So we'll try to make sure that happens. So thank you. Any questions for this group? Thank you very much. So next we have Jennifer, is it Ruda?
Rueda.
And Armella
Dennis.
And Donna Chastain. Okay. And you may begin whenever you're ready.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Rueda. I've taught for Clackamas Community College for almost 10 years, and I'm here to talk about SB 196. As past president for 3 years and co-president for one additional year of the Part-Time Faculty Association at Clackamas Community College, I know how hard it is for some part-time educators to find affordable health insurance, and that's true for me as well. I know personally how hard it is to access health care. In fact, before the ACA, I could not afford health insurance. Instead, I relied on OHSU and Providence Health, the insurance, the whole, the clinics, everything, to give me a reduced rate. That is, I asked for and applied for what OHSU calls charity care and what Providence calls financial aid, and they would write off about 50% of my bill. Luckily, I didn't need to go to the doctor very often. When I started out as a part-time faculty at Clackamas, I looked back through my taxes. I was only making $31,000, between $31,000 and $37,000 a year as a part-timer. I make more now and things have changed, but I couldn't afford health insurance premiums, obviously. Okay, in addition, although the ACA is now the law, some part-timers or adjuncts still have to come up with a large monthly premium in addition to their rent, mortgage, car payments, and student loans, among other things like credit card payments. Senate Bill 196 would really help my fellow adjunct instructors have access to health insurance and therefore health care, which in my mind should be a right as a human being. Not everyone is able to take the time out of work to come to the Capitol to testify, so I want to share testimony from another educator who is directly impacted by this legislation. This testimony, I'm finished, and this testimony is from Jerry Loveless.
You still, see, they only get it this many times, so if you want to leave it as a, you've got a few seconds, so you can go part of it.
Okay, I have written testimony from Jerry Loveless, which
that's
I will
perfect.
Submit. Thank
that's
you.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Chairman Roland, members of the committee, my name is Armel Dennis. I was an instructor in French and anthropology at Oregon State University for almost 15 years, first as a graduate teaching assistant and then as a non-tenured instructor. I was lucky enough, combining employment in two departments at the same institution, to be near full-time for the major part of my time at OSU, so that for a long time I received full benefits and I did not have to worry about getting health care for my family. But liberal arts in general and world languages in particular have never been well-funded in this state or elsewhere in the nation. And our unit was starved for funds, so that classes who didn't meet enrollment minimum were canceled, and pretty soon entire programs were eliminated. For non-tenured faculty members like myself, that meant living in constant fear of losing the better part of your job, and with it, your health insurance. It did happen to some colleagues of mine, being told barely 3 days before the start of the term that two of your three classes were canceled and that effective the first of the next month, your benefits would be discontinued. Institutions of higher education rely increasingly on part-time, non-tenured instructors and adjuncts to teach the bulk of undergraduate programs, including very large introductory courses. Adjuncts are really on the front lines of educating our Oregon students, which is a mighty responsibility, but we are not given the means to do a good job. Our precariousness is detrimental to students' education. Many among us have little job security and juggle teaching assignments at several institutions, leaving us with little time to focus on what really matters, engaging young minds with creative curriculum, giving extra help to struggling students, encouraging excellence. In these conditions, it becomes much harder to be an effective teacher, and when teachers can't teach, we all lose. Senate Bill 196 would make a world of difference for non-tenured faculty in Oregon, especially in these times of great uncertainty regarding the future of healthcare in our country. Many of us only have healthcare thanks to the ACA, which is clunky and expensive, but at least provides some access for the time being. Having healthcare safety would be huge, and I strongly urge you to support Senate Bill 196. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Good afternoon. I'm Donna Chastain, Interim Chief Human Resources Officer at Oregon State University, and I'm here today representing the seven public universities. We support the goal of Senate Bill 196 to aggregate hours for employees to provide health insurance benefits for working families. In fact, the universities currently coordinate and aggregate hours for part-time employees that work at multiple universities if their combined FTE meets the 0.5 FTE eligibility requirement. But we do rely on the employees to notify us of their combined appointments. In support of this effort, we also participated in the HECS Senate Bill 113 work group in 2015. And although we are in support of the concept of this bill, we continue to have concerns regarding its implementation. Our concerns include the universities currently offer health care to employees working 0.5 FTE, but this bill ties eligibility to PERS eligibility. This, in effect, lowers eligibility from a 0.5 FTE for the universities to a 0.3 FTE for our 12-month employees and a 0.4 FTE for our 9-month employees. There's also a financial impact, so we'd want to make sure that the legislature adequately funded to allow us to provide the health insurance for these employees. The bill also requires that the HEC review and we presume approve the policies that govern the university's authority over our employees and our human resources policies, and this would begin to erode our authority over those policies and our employees. We also currently do not have the ability to track employment across the multiple institutions. In the Senate Bill 113 work group, we identified the differences and complexities in how the universities and the community colleges calculate FTE and how we determine PERS eligibility. This still needs to be addressed. And there's also unintended consequences for employees that work in only one institution across our various populations, classified employees, and our non-teaching faculty, and there would be additional costs to provide this level of benefits. Thank you.
Thank you, and I will make sure that Senator Dembro understands some of those issues if he doesn't already, because he did talk about amendments for this bill. So
thank you.
And thank you all. Oh, questions, anybody? Okay, thank you. So Kim Colantino in the first half of the group, and then the other people, I just want to thank you. We will get to you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and committee members. I know that Jennifer has spoken to her. I'm sorry, I'm Kim Colantino at Chemeketa Community College. I'm the English program chair, so chair of one of the largest programs on our campus. And we're just like every other community college in Oregon, in that about 75% of our workforce is adjunct or part-time. Jennifer had spoken to how much she earned about 10 years ago, but I did some crunching of numbers. If we have a part-timer working as many ILCs, as many units of classes as they're allowed under part-time status at our school, that instructor will, pardon me, gross $14,425. So assuming that instructor were also able to work the same amount of time at another school that pays about the same rate at step one, that person, of course, would be making around $28,800 a year. I looked at the American Data Processing Institute of what that would account for per month take-home pay. That instructor would be making $1,900 a month. Now, rent per month this year, according to the Statesman Journal, in Salem for a one-bedroom apartment is $1,044 a month. It's completely understandable how someone could be working full-time in a white-collar professional job and still not be able to afford health care. The first instructor I helped hire as chair, I'm going to call him David, was a veteran of the Middle East conflicts. He was all but dissertation for a PhD, so he was overqualified to work for us and had years of experience teaching. He came to Oregon with his one-year-old child and wife and started working for us and one other Oregon institution, cobbling together a full-time assignment between the two. Within about a year, he contacted me and told me he had to take on a third job with the Air National Guard in order to make his health care payments for his family, which even through the ACA were $735 a month. About 2 years into a pretty stellar teaching career with us at Chemeketa, he called me and told me he simply could not do it anymore. And he quit teaching. That happens a lot for us. There are a lot of people behind me who dedicate their time for 10 years, 15 years, muscling along doing this, but I do want to speak to the enormous turnover that I see in our program due to this issue. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for being here and being a part of this. We're going to leave this one open because we will come back to it. We're going to open another public hearing on Senate Bill 206, and we'll have a short explanation. And as she's doing that, I'll invite up Tracy Hodgson and Andrea Henderson.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 206 requires the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to develop a policy permitting faculty at community colleges to receive compensation from consulting, appearances or speeches, intellectual property owned within the community college, providing services for a private corporation, individual or entity, and performing public duties paid by private organizations.
You can get started. Andrea's on her way. She knows how to get there.
Yeah, of course. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Tracy Hodgson. I teach history at Chemeketa Community College here in Salem, and I'm also a board member of the Oregon Education Association. And I speak in support of Senate Bill 206. This bill is simple. It simply allows community college faculty to have the same professional freedom long afforded to university faculty for the benefit of students. Presently, university professors are allowed and indeed expected to write books, articles, and book reviews, and speak as experts at professional conferences. They earn royalties, stipends, and honoraria while engaged in these activities, exempt from the restrictions of state ethics law. This bill will allow community college faculty to have that same professional freedom. At the community college, our focus is primarily on teaching students. Textbook publishers frequently want to tap our expertise. so they can find out how they can better meet the needs of today's students. They pay modest sums for our feedback. Faculty are often offered honoraria to go speak about their expertise at conferences. And many of us, more of us than ever really, are seeking to publish textbooks. And many of those efforts are really efforts to make inexpensive student textbooks for students. For most of these efforts, community college faculty can reasonably expect to earn a few hundred dollars in compensation every year, far less than university professors might expect. Yet in the current legal landscape, most of these activities are not allowed by state ethics law. Like all publicly employees, we are limited to make $50 a year in an activity that is linked to our position as a college instructor. So if we assign a textbook to our class that we wrote and for which we're collecting royalties, we're in violation of state ethics laws. If we give our expertise to a publisher, we're in violation of state ethics laws. Ethics constraints force us to engage in those kinds of professional activities for almost no compensation, while professors at the university receive fair compensation for those same services. So this bill would bring equity to the educational landscape of Oregon, allowing community college faculty that same freedom to receive royalties, honoraria, and stipends as university faculty. And the students will be the beneficiaries because they'll have greater access to inexpensive textbooks that are focused on their educational needs. It's simply the fair thing to do. So I thank you for your consideration of this legislation.
Thank you very much. Andrea.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. We are very supportive of the concept behind this bill and actually brought legislation several years ago to fix this. Essentially right now, if you are a community college faculty, you cannot sell your textbooks and make profit off of it in the way that university faculty can. We're very supportive of the concept. We would like to see an amendment in the bill. Currently, the bill as drafted directs HEC to essentially set up rules to make this work. And what we would suggest instead is that we just mirror the language that's in the current statute for university faculty and just add community college faculty to that statute to have it work better and keep the conversations at the local level. Be happy to answer any questions you might have.
So any questions? So I guess from my perspective, I was surprised that they didn't have the same requirements when I knew we had done that for the college for their faculty. So I guess what I would ask, when you come up with the language, I'll authorize you to work with Lisa to come up with an amendment that does that. That would be helpful for me and for her. Any other questions or thoughts? Okay, so thank you very
much.
Thank you.
Thanks for considering. Is there anyone here that wants to speak to 206 before we move on? Because those are the only two that were signed up. Okay. Do we know if... So we're going to close the public hearing on 206.
Staff is supposed to be getting
her. We're going to wait just a moment because Senator Lori Moss Anderson is next door and she is the introducer of the next bill, which has to do with Senate Bill 111. Invite a couple of these other people up from this one. That doesn't look like that. Oh, so we're going to open, did I do that?
Yeah,
did you? I don't know. We're going to open Senate Bill 111, and we're going to call Senator Myers Anderson and have a short explanation by our administrator.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 111 replaces the bill's statutory provisions. It requires the Oregon Department of Education to develop and administer a pilot program to assist school districts and education service districts in increasing the use of Medicaid billing, and it establishes program requirements. It also requires ODE to provide technical assistance to school districts and education service districts. It appropriates an unspecified amount of money from the general fund for the pilot program, creation of the Medicaid billing plan, providing training, assisting school nurses, and ongoing technical assistance.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Moss Anderson, and I'm from the Gresham area, East Multnomah County. And Senate Bill 111 is a very important bill. I'm a retired public health nurse, and I was a school-based health clinic nurse at Oregon City High School. I worked very closely with the school nurse there at Oregon City. She was one nurse that covered, I forget how many thousands of kids. But I'm going to be very brief. This is a mechanism that we need to get going in the state of Oregon. Right now, general fund money is paying for nurses in the school. They need to start looking at billing Medicaid dollars, particularly. And although with the pilot projects, I think that a whole maybe new system is going to be developed. So I highly encourage this bill to go move forward. It's very important. It was too broad at the beginning, especially during this budget cycle. And you're going to have some really important people coming before you to give you more particulars of the bill.
Okay. Any questions? I will say that when we started doing Medicaid billing in Coos Bay, when I was principal, it brought in a fair amount of resources. I'm not sure that it paid the entire nurse cost, but it allowed us to keep a nurse at our school district for a lot longer than most people. And then we got a health clinic that was helpful as well. But the billing made sense, and the form we filled out, our ESD ran it, so it was a pretty good program. And I don't know what's transpired in the last 11 years, but I hope that this gets people the idea that there are ways to go about getting federal funding to make sure that we have nurses in every school, which will be really great.
We should have one nurse for every 750 students, so yes, we have.
Yet?
We're not there yet. Okay. And Silverton has developed a fairly good model, but I'll keep it brief.
Okay.
You'll get
Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Senator. Is there a way, or does the bill contemplate making sure that Medicaid is billed for nursing services, but kids' Medicaid plans are not charged for physical therapy, occupational or speech therapy? Because those have recently been capped, and I know that I've advised families not to turn over their Medicaid cards because they then are not able to get medically based services outside of school. And a lot of times in school, that PT-OT speech is consult only instead of direct service.
And I think that's why we are having pilots. I think there's going to be a whole lot that's going to be learned on what works and what doesn't work. Yeah.
Okay, but would you follow up?
Yeah.
Would you be open to just being really clear that we don't want to cut into the
absolutely
to the
not
OT speech
no.
for folks?
Absolutely not.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
So next we have Ellie Sanders, Andy Blondo, and Kathleen Johnson. And some may be outside, so we'll assume that Ms. Johnson is outside and coming in, so we can just get started.
We ready?
Yep.
Good afternoon, Chair Rob. Excuse me. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin. The rest of the members of the committee. For the record, I'm Eli Sanders, school health specialist for the Oregon Department of Education. Hoping to provide some background as well as some notes on the current amendment. As part of my role at ODE, I helped staff the most recent task force on school nursing. As part of this governor's appointed task force on school nursing, we identified multiple issues facing our schools. In order to meet federal and state education requirements, Oregon school districts use general fund education dollars to provide health services for students with complex and life-threatening health conditions when they could be accessing existing federal health dollars. In 1999, school districts and ESDs reported expenditures of $18 million from their state school fund revenue for delivery of health services. By 2015, these expenditures for delivery of health services climbed nearly doubled to $35 million. There's been a significant increase in the number of students attending school with complex chronic health conditions, many life-threatening, which require complex medical treatments and frequent interventions by a school nurse. 79 of our 197 current school districts in Oregon report no school nursing services, leaving roughly 30,000 students with no access to school nurses. What we also know is many districts report school nurse ratios much higher than what is recommended and or required. Without school nurses, districts then rely on classified staff. In many cases, the front office secretary or educational assistants to meet complex healthcare needs. It is against the law for anyone other than a registered nurse to delegate care for students while they are at school. So this causes serious safety and health risks for students and their families, impacts school attendance and engagement, and poses an avoidable risk to school district staff and employees. Currently, Oregon rule and statute requires school districts to maintain a prevention-oriented health services program for their students. And this includes, per ORS 336.201, that there's a 1 to 225 ratio for school nurse to medically complex students. For nurses and medically fragile students, it's 1 to every 125 medically fragile student. And then certainly nursing-dependent students, we require a 1-to-1 ratio. The overall kind of general population school nurse ratio is currently in law a recommendation at 1 to 750. As part of the task force, Oregon Department of Education also identified that we do indeed have an enforcement authority under Division 22 related to school nurse ratios. The Dash 2 amendments, with little funding to meet school health needs, one option is to bill Medicaid. However, this can be a complex endeavor for districts. The Dash 2 amendments seeks general funds to set up a statewide system to support districts to bill Medicaid. This would include funding additional capacity at ODE to work directly with our school districts, including a full-time school health specialist, as well as Medicaid specialists specific to this project. Oregon Department of Education will also develop and administer a pilot project to assist 9 specific school districts who volunteer to participate to increase their Medicaid billing capacity. In addition, the Oregon Department of Education will develop a statewide system to support Medicaid billing to school districts and education service districts participating in the pilot program. Lastly, statewide system will then be expanded to cover all districts. We expect to cover all districts after the pilot project. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for the opportunity.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, committee members. My name is Andy Belando. I'm the superintendent of Silver Falls School District, located about 20 minutes east of Salem in the community of Silverton. I come to you today in support of SB 111, and we'll share an example of the potential for Medicaid direct billing as an effective funding source to address school nursing needs in Oregon. First, just some basic information about my school district. Well, it's nestled in the eastern part of the Willamette Valley. It really has many elements found in school districts from throughout Oregon. We're geographically large, about 260 square miles. We have 13 schools, just under 4,000 students. We have one comprehensive high school and multiple elementary schools, and most of our elementary schools are K-8, with a range of about 80 students, at our smallest, up to 325 students at our largest. So it's no secret that Oregon school districts are, again, nervous about adequate funding. I'm developing a budget now for my school district and doing everything possible just to maintain current programs and, of course, staffing levels. However, since 2011, we have utilized a funding source which has provided a reliable stream of revenue for nursing services. At the time, and under the leadership of our resourceful special education director, we pursued reimbursement through Medicaid direct billing. It worked. It currently works. And it provides for 2.5 FTE of nurses in our school district, and at this point today, this equates to a ratio of about 1 to 1,500 students. While not ideal, it surely is much closer than I know some school districts in Oregon. This pursuit required a lot of upfront work, a steep learning curve by my staff, and a continued commitment by staff members, especially our school nurses, to help make it happen. So my support for SB 111 is given really in concert with a few bullet points, and those are: this bill draws attention to this funding source, I think, which is meaningful. It educates school districts, provides an essential education to staff members. It appears to help school districts navigate complex requirements, and they aren't easy. They are complex, but once you get them down, they do work. I believe it's low risk. A 9 school district pilot for a few years seems reasonable for determining its effectiveness and next steps. And finally, for us, Medicaid direct billing is a reliable funding source which has helped to nearly eliminate the funding uncertainty variable for an ever-increasing need in our schools. And as superintendent, this helps me breathe a legitimate sigh of relief. when it comes to knowing where our dollars are coming from. Knowing other school districts could experience the same with state support, in my mind, is notable. So I will share, just in conclusion, that my support does not address the reality of our nursing shortage and the availability of school nurses in Oregon. I think we all understand that reality, especially in our rural settings. We are fortunate to have access to high-quality nurses in Silver Falls School District. My support does not all address the availability of funding Medicaid revenue in the future at an adequate level like we are experiencing right now. It works, again, because that adequate funding level is available. And I would like to share that my support would change if in the future use of other funding sources such as high-cost disability revenue were first required prior to Medicaid direct billing, and that's just a statement I think of importance for me to make. Otherwise, thank you very much for the time to share some input.
Any questions for either of these? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So with that, we're going to have Katie Ruskelly and Tanya Jo Robinson come on up, and you can bring any guests you want with you. And we do try to keep it 2 minutes, so there'll be a little clock over there for you.
I'll do my best.
When it gets going. Okay, that's all I can ask.
My name is Katie Ruskelly. I'm a district nurse for Greater Albany Public Schools. One thing I want to make clear is that I am not a school nurse. I'm a district nurse. Yes, I work very closely with a few students I manage care for, but I manage their care. I'm not the one providing it. There are two nurses in our district. We oversee the care of 9,600 students. We have written 411 protocols for the students at GAPS. That means there are 411 hospital-grade nursing tasks that are being performed daily in our schools. Because there are only two nurses, these 411 tasks are spread out between 22 schools, and there is no way we could accomplish all these tasks in a day. How do we do it? One word, delegation. Because of Division 47 of the Nurse Practice Act, we are allowed within very specific parameters to delegate nursing tasks to non-medically trained professionals. Every day, as you know, teachers, office managers, and classroom staff are performing all kinds of nursing tasks, from administering insulin to diabetic students to urinary catheterization, all under the delegation of one of our two registered nurses. I was assisting with the training of staff and teachers on the administration of a life-saving medication for a student in our district diagnosed with adrenal insufficiency. Because this student is not equipped chemically to handle stress, she requires an intramuscular injection. This injection will save her life if her body experiences an extremely stressful event, for example, falling off the monkey bars and breaking her arm. During the training, one of the office staff turned to me with fear in her eyes and said, "I've never given someone a shot before, Katie. What does it feel like? What does it feel like? What does it feel like to be a nurse? What does it feel like in the heat of an emergency to take a vial and a syringe in your hand and carefully drop the correct amount of medication? What does it feel like to take years of study in anatomy and physiology into your hands as you feel the musculature in the bones of a person's arm or leg to find the correct landmarks to know where to give the shot? What does it feel like to push a needle through young, thick skin, then to press down on the plunger, all in order to save someone's life? I've given countless injections in my career. I am a nurse. The people I'm delegating to and training didn't sign up to be a nurse. They took the job so they could be an aide in a classroom or a secretary at a school's front office. They went to school to become a teacher, not to become a nurse. Those 411 medical interventions, we can't do them. We can only delegate them. We need help. This is a state of emergency. Let's let office managers be office managers and teachers be teachers. Only a senator knows how to be a senator, and only a nurse knows how to be a nurse. Please use your knowledge and your influence to help students have access to nurses at school. We desperately need nurses in school, and for that, we need the funding. Please support Senate Bill 111.
Thank you.
My name is Tanya Jo Robinson, and this is my son, Owen. I just asked to extend a little bit of forgiveness and grace because today I'm not really giving you just my voice. I'm giving you the voice of myself, my two children, and really every special needs child in the state and their parents. So I will go off what I wrote here because, well, that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm a mother of four. Two of my children are affected by KCTD7, a rare genetic disorder which requires 24/7 care by a registered nurse or individuals that are trained or delegated to provide their care. The care involves feeding, urine catheterization, suctioning protocols, diastat administration for seizures, and the list goes on. Due to their fragile nature, I've been involved closely with the school district since 2005 and prior with early intervention. My oldest daughter, Cassie Jo, passed away unexpectedly at the age of 11. She was in sixth grade.
I spent most of her 6 years in public. I'm sorry.
Okay. Just take your time.
I spent most of her 6 years in public school advocating for the care she needed. During those years, I was just an angry parent and just wanted the district to fix it. Little did I know the resources were such that a fix wouldn't come that easy. I'm happy to say that the last 7 months of her time in public school, she had 7 consecutive months of medical coverage and was able to enjoy and thrive in the environment while all of her medical needs were being met. I don't even remember going to school much in that 7 months, which is pretty amazing for a parent of a medically fragile child like her. Her daily team included a respiratory therapist and a personal care assistant and an RN overseeing her care. Fast forward 6 years. Owen, as you see here, also lives with KCTD7 and requires a high level of care. I spent much of his earlier years advocating for the same needs as my daughter. Unfortunately, his need level has exceeded hers, which has made things a little more difficult, even though his path has been a little smoother overall because of what we learned from caring for Cassie Jo. There has been and continues to be a few bumps in the road. I now work in special education. I'm a personal care assistant for the Albany School District. I have a clearer picture now of the challenges that the school has in providing care for my medically fragile children. I can't say for certain, but I think my 2 children are of the most fragile that Albany has ever had, and you know, many around the state. One district nurse to approximately 10,000 children. I know it's a little less, but it really equals a disaster. There is no way that one nurse can get to know my child or a personal care assistant well enough to delegate or oversee the care of my child while monitoring the countless needs of others, of other children in the district, some of which are as fragile as mine. This is where the idea of delegation is very difficult. You need to know the child, you need to understand what they're going through to be able to delegate. If you don't, you can't feel comfortable, and these nurses are at risk because they're performing life-saving procedures on these children with really knowing just a little bit, one being suctioning. This has created the need for using agencies to provide care. In many cases, this has not been successful because of the lack of continuity in care, which continuity in care supports overall health. In addition, the pay is considerably less than offered in a hospital. I know this because I'm the nosy parent. I ask questions. How can we expect a highly qualified nurse to provide care in the environment with less support and an increased workload and liability while making less money than in a more secure environment? A factor that's often overlooked is the stress on families of these children. Until 2 years ago, I could not seek employment due to the lack of continuity in care. How can a parent send their fragile child to school knowing their access to medical care is limited? This created financial hardship and forced our family to use public services that we wouldn't have otherwise needed. I might add that now that I'm employed, we don't need those services. Not only did this have an impact financially, but the emotional toll on our whole family is immeasurable. If the everyday life of a medically fragile child isn't already enough, just imagine what this has added. In closing, I ask you to please consider giving our schools the funds they need to provide adequate nursing care across the board. The positive ripple effect will be much broader than in the classroom. For children like Owen and Cassie Jo, every day in school is an accomplishment. Each milestone completed is like receiving a diploma. For Cassie Jo, school was her life. She lived her future in each passing day. Nursing care in schools isn't just about medical care. It's about quality of life, a life that I didn't ask for, Cassie Jo didn't ask for, and Owen didn't ask for, but the one that we were given and we conquer each day. Please consider quality of life for all children and support Senate Bill 111. Support our children's access to their free, appropriate education, regardless of their medical status.
Any questions, Ms. Group? Thank you very much.
And she couldn't be here because she's in heaven, but this is Cassie Jo, another child like Owen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So next, we're going to have Anina Bikris, Jen Becker, and Soren Metzger. And I will tell you, when you're a dean of students at a high school and your nurse ends up having cancer eventually passes away during the year, so she's not there very often, and you become the nurse, it is really frustrating because you have to learn a lot of things really quickly. You have a nurse that comes in and visits, but they don't have the same knowledge. And my office became the office where that was at. And I learned a whole lot more about the medical fragile people that were at my school than I knew before. But it's a big responsibility, and it wears heavily on people that have to take on those responsibilities. So go ahead. Thank you for being here.
Chair Roblin, thank you. My name is Dinah Ficaris. I'm a school nurse in the Beaverton School District. I'm also the president-elect of the National Association of School Nurses. And I testify to you today as the chairman of the task force, which looked at identifying funding streams for school nursing services. Senate Bill 111 is one piece of what our task force looked at. It will provide the needed infrastructure at ODE to be able to help school districts understand the complexity of Medicaid billing, maximize the idea of Medicaid billing, and really try to then have those funds go back to support the nursing services that are generating them. And just a word, Senator Gelsler, the money that school districts can bill is a separate pot of Medicaid money than the money that families use. So the monies that we would bill would not impact the families' benefits to receive those services through Medicaid billing. So I just wanted to clarify that. In the Beaverton School District, I have 4,865 students. I write approximately 500 individual health management plans that I'm responsible for training staff and teachers how to deal with safely. The services that I provide are not provided by school-based health centers, so therefore school-based health centers won't help me. What will help me and those 500 students is an increase in school nursing services, and this bill is one step to begin that process of increasing school nurses in the state of Oregon. Everyone agrees that school nurses are important, that we can help education. It's just how do we fund them? And we believe that Senate Bill 111 is one step toward identifying a possible funding stream for school nursing services. And I'd ask you to support this important legislation.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Soren Metzger, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon School Employees Association. You've heard a little bit about what this bill does, so I'm not going to summarize that. I will just talk about why this bill is particularly important to OSEA members. OSEA members are the school support personnel, non-medical school support personnel, including secretaries, instructional and educational assistants, who these tasks are being delegated to. This is a really important bill because at this point, I have heard from folks in Urbana-Lapine, Central, Coos Bay, Corvallis, Dallas, Eugene, Gresham, Barlow, and the list goes on and on from folks in our chapters around the state on this issue. Very, very important. The type of services that these that are currently being delegated to our folks are catheterizations, as you've heard, tube feeding, seizure treatments, administration of pharmaceuticals, including medically prescribed narcotics, blood glucose monitoring and insulin injections, among other things. Our folks, in summary, I would say, feel like they're being provided sufficient training by these really incredible and talented nurses. They do feel like they can come and ask questions when they do have questions about the medical needs of the students, and for the most part are comfortable providing these medical procedures. However, in many cases, if these folks refuse to provide these medical procedures, there are consequences. I would say as we talk about consequences, one of the things that we should keep in mind is that it's possible that these folks who are not medically trained can possibly make a mistake. And according to our folks, should they make a mistake, they can be written up, they can be terminated, and in some cases they feel like they could be held liable and possibly sued. I would also say it's important to consider the consequences in terms of a mistake for the students. And according to our folks, folks, these mistakes could actually result in serious injury, comas, and possibly death. So with that being said, I'd just like to conclude and say for all of these reasons, OSEA supports Senate Bill 111 with a -2 amendment and any other effort that this legislative body can make to provide on-site nursing staff in all Oregon schools to administer these medical procedures. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Any questions for these? Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
So, Jessica Duke, Lynn Lantern, Bonnie, I think it's O'Terran, and we had called Jen Baker before, Becker, and so if she's here, she's certainly welcome to show up. Jen Becker, I guess it was. Okay, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. Thank you so much for having me today. I am Jessica Duke, and I am manager of adolescent and school health programs within the Oregon Health Authority Public Health Division. My colleague from Oregon Department of Education explained a lot of what is also included in my written testimony, which you have, so I won't repeat that, and I'll be brief today. I'm pleased to testify today to offer a public health perspective on Senate Bill 111, specifically the -2 amendment. It's important to note that school nurses support the health of students so they can be successful at school. School nurses provide acute nursing care, health screenings, behavioral health assessment, and extensive case management. Their work includes public health functions of surveillance, chronic disease prevention, emergency preparedness, and ongoing health education. Eli Sanders already spoke to the ratios required of school nurses in Oregon law, and with the goal of having one registered nurse for every 750 students in the general school population, our current ratio, a statewide average, is one school nurse for every 2,635 students in school. So we're very far from meeting that goal. And we believe that this bill is one mechanism that might help us answer that goal by bringing in Medicaid funding to support school nursing. So I thank you very much for your time today and your consideration of SB 111.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Senator Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Lynn Lanham. I am a school health nurse for Salem Kaiser. Been a school nurse for over 20 years and have seen such an increase in childhood illnesses over the years that everyone has done such a great job talking to you about the special needs students, but I also want to talk about another group of students that we see a lot of and give you just some numbers. Nationwide, 1 in 10 children have asthma. So chronic asthma we see all the time, number one cause of absenteeism in school-aged children. Diabetes, there's been a 23% increase in diabetic students. For us, that would be the type 1 diabetic students that require insulin. So that's a huge number of kids that require nursing care every single day. We have in our district 20 students that we give insulin shots to as a health services team. A small part of our pie for 20 students for 40,000 kids in our district, but needed. And we chose as a team to do that because we were concerned about putting other people in jeopardy because they may make an insulin error. 1 in 13, we see an increase in severe allergies. So 1 in 13 kids nationwide have severe allergies that would require emergency epinephrine for a severe allergic reaction. And then the last one would be 1 in 20 students have epilepsy. So they have a seizure disorder. And in our district, that would require training for either a nasal Versed type of medication or rectal diastat. So we put an enormous pressure on our educators to provide medical care on top of managing behaviors and trying to educate kids. I've talked to parents who are afraid to send their kids to school because they're afraid nobody's watching them. When I make follow-up phone calls to parents who have children with asthma, they're afraid that we're not going to recognize, that school staff won't recognize that their child needs assistance, and so they're keeping their kids home. As a school nurse in buildings, I've also seen where it's very easy because school staff are concerned about making an error, and when a kid comes in and says they're not feeling well, that they send them straight home. And studies have shown that if a nurse is in a building, that we're a lot more likely to send that student right back to class because we know and we can make that judgment call because we went to school to be trained to assess students and to make decisions, and we're able to call healthcare providers if we need to, where we can't ask educators to do that. So I appreciate you considering the needs that are continuing to increase nationwide for our kids in school.
Thank you.
Hi.
Chair and committee. My name is Bonnie O'Hearn, and I am also a school nurse here in Salem, and I also have 3,500 students in six schools, so nothing you haven't heard. But the biggest thing, too, is as a nurse, and the compassion that we feel when we have to delegate or walk out of that school, leaving in hopes that someone's going to take care of that student with the medical needs that they have been trained to do but don't really want to do. And we went to school to want to do that. If there was more of me, I could stay and do more at the schools. I can make that attendance change. And I have done medical billing through Medicaid, Medi-Cal before, and it has proven to be quite a generator of money. And the superintendent from Silverton said it very eloquently, and it's been successful for him. And I think it's worth a try to do, because we need the funding to get more of us, meaning nurses in the school setting, to care for those children like this mother over here. So I'm not going to, well, I don't watch on anything because everybody said it, but attendance is also one of my biggies, and I'd like to see more of our students be in school because being medical fragile or just having asthma is not a reason to stay home.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that would like to speak to this particular bill? Because that was everybody on our list. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And
thank you, and I want to particularly thank, and I know what the one parent's gone, the parents that have come to be willing to share this. I also hope that people out in the community are starting to get a bigger picture of what it takes to be a school and a community and all of the different people that make that work, because the job is a lot different than most of our people remember their schools being, because they didn't know they had to deal with all these things, because they didn't. They were the student just going through, and they were obviously oftentimes oblivious to all the things that nurses and other people were doing in that building. And I think it is important as we look at the education and the funding we're going to do to realize how many different kinds of things educators do every day. So with that, I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 111, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 142. We'll hear a short explanation. Marcia Davis, you want to come on up?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 142 requires school districts to ensure that fourth graders who do not meet grade level standards for reading are screened for symptoms of Erlen syndrome beginning with the 2017-18 school year. The bill requires the State Board of Education to enact rules governing qualifications of individuals who will conduct the screenings. It requires the Oregon Department of Education to designate an Erlen syndrome specialist, declares an emergency effective on passage.
And welcome.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. And can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm Marcia Davis, and I'm in support of Senate Bill 142. I'm a certified Erlen diagnostician and trainer and education therapist in private practice in Salem. I represent a loose network of certified Erlen screeners all over the state in various settings, some in schools, some in community colleges, juvenile department, Salem Health, occupational therapy, a pediatric clinic in Southern Oregon has some screeners there, and we all would love to see children in Oregon all have access to certified Erlen screenings and the accommodations. Erlen syndrome is a type of light sensitivity that is a pretty silent issue. It coexists with many learning disabilities, many other medical issues, and it overlaps about two-thirds of the time with dyslexia. There's a variety of symptoms. The most easily recognizable are the struggling readers who have distortions on the page, which is often like luxury of this at all. Let's see. I wanted to just scoot through. There's just a few of these I wanted to.
She's going to have it on the screen in a second.
Okay. So those with reading problems that might have distortions on the page, that is a lot like an optical illusion. It produces eye strain from the glare, headaches, losing place,
reading fatigue, sleepiness, poor attention and concentration, and of course, inability to really get and utilize good reading instruction, and gain fluency and that sort of a thing.
So. Hey, so that has to do with the time.
I'm timed out already?
That's for 2 minutes. We're going to let you do something.
Okay. So it's, it can affect those with good reading skills as well. A trained, certified Erlen screener can help these kids not slip through the cracks. You'll be hearing from representative of the juvenile department in a while, again, representing those kids who have slipped through the cracks that could have been helped earlier. Some who could not come today. There's much work done at Lynn Benton Community College in the Student Center for Accessibility Resources, and all of those students that are helped by a couple of different grants say, I've had all these problems since elementary school, and it's too bad I couldn't have found out what this is, had the Erlen colored overlays and accommodations at that time. It also can be your attention deficit kids because of the focusing and attention, and there's an overlap of anywhere between 30% and 60% in those cases. Headaches, sometimes children are getting headaches, and by the way, we're seeing more severe symptoms in recent years among younger children compared to when this was first discovered. And the research first started in the 1980s at UC Long Beach in a federally granted grant study among struggling college students. Helen Erlen is the one credited with discovering and furthering this information. But the increase is due to the time all of us, including children, spend in front of screens. And that's becoming an increasing concern. And this can identify this. Also, there would be head injuries and other things that can be identified if a staff is actually trained. Has nothing to do with 20/20 vision. That's a separate issue. This is not identified in any other tests. It does not. It's not a curriculum. It doesn't teach phonics, but it removes a barrier to learning, so that the child can progress. If this was one of the, I'm not gonna do any more visuals. I know we don't have time. So if this was one of the first tests that could be done for special education referrals, it could greatly cut down the referrals for special education. It could cut down on less, time-consuming tests and meetings for the school staff, lost time for the students themselves, both immediately in gaining reading fluency and through the years. There have been some studies. I can get these electronically to you if you like. I just want to highlight a couple that have to do somehow with third graders, that within 3 months, each group gained at least between 1 and 2 years in reading fluency, accuracy, comprehension. And another one, there were actually a sizable amount that actually were able to exit special education and become mainstreamed again. I know that can't be duplicated everywhere. This happened in Massachusetts. And in Mississippi, there was legislation in 2014 that any third grader that could not read up to grade level must be retained. And the following year, they started screening everyone for Erlen syndrome and giving them the colored overlays. And in the last 2 years, they have passed all of their third graders. Thank you very much for this chance to present this. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Any questions? Yes.
Are you saying that this isn't an eye problem? It's a brain processing
yes.
problem.
Yes.
Okay.
So
And just so you know, Senator Cruz is working really hard on having a conversation about all of these different kinds of issues with OHSU, and looking at coming together with some ideas about a lot of different kinds of testing things, which may be, am I speaking correctly, Senator Cruz?
You are. Actually, the work group was headed up by the Pediatric Society of Oregon. So.
Okay, so we'll keep this in mind with that one as well as it. Here by itself. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
So we have Chris Kemp, Shelley Warfield, and Kay McNally. Okay. And again, we'll be 2 minutes on your screen, so we're going to try to keep going, because after we get done with you guys, we're going to start talking to some people who came in early and gave you everybody an opportunity. So thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the Senate Committee. For the record, my name is Chris Kemp, and I'm an education advocate through the Marion County Juvenile Department. Before I began with the Juvenile Department, I did not know what Erlen Syndrome was. And I became certified as part of my position, and they started screening youth in 2004 who were in the program, which is a small subgroup of kids in the juvenile program. These kids that we work with do very poorly in the school academically and or behaviorally, and a lot of times there's a host of problems go with that. And in the last 9 months, we started giving a short self-test to every youth who came through the juvenile department. And I know that there's some statistics out there that Marcia didn't mention, but 70% of our youth who took that short self-test fell in the range of a full diagnostic screening. And that kind of parallels the data out there that our at-risk youth and other populations have a tendency to score in the higher range. What I have seen in my screening is youth who get an overlay will be like, oh my gosh, I just had one with dyslexia recently, and he looked at the page and goes, I can see the letters on the page better than I ever have before. Like, the letters don't look weird. And that kind of surprised me. It still surprises me when I hear that. A lot of our youth complain of headaches or light sensitivity. Being in this room for the last couple hours, if I didn't have Erlen glasses myself, I wouldn't have been able to handle this real well, but I never knew what it was until I started being screened for Erlen myself. So they're just surprised, like, wow, I don't get headaches anymore. It's just been, what I see it as is a non-invasive way of treating something, and it's the effects are immediate. And it's really been an honor for me to be able to see youth helped by this measure. So I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you. Go ahead.
These are my migraine glasses.
Okay, got it.
These are my reading glasses. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Shelley Moorfeld. I'm an Erlen screener and a substitute teacher in Woodburn. In my capacity as a long-term second grade substitute teacher, I saw dramatic changes in reading fluency and comprehension with Erlen overlays. As my students gained levels, I was given the lowest groups, and all the students ended up reading better with the overlays. I had parent-teacher conferences with 100% attendance rate, where parents were provided information about the difference overlays were making. They all bought them. I believe it is a net cost savings, meetings you don't have to have, kids who don't wind up in the juvenile justice systems, and all the rest that implies. My brother couldn't read in school and was a behavior problem. He just started a 1,000-page book. I also have a comment from a teacher I worked with. Shelley, some of the kids could read so much better with the overlays. One girl in particular had her fluency double when she did two readings with me back to back, one without the overlays and one with them. It helped her be more confident and hopeful about reading. Another one from an adult that I met. To whom it concerns, I have been unable to read all my life. Shelley Moorfeld tried some plastic colored sheets and I was able to read for the first time. Now I can travel because I can read the road signs. No child should have to go through what I went through in school when there is such an easy and simple way to help people like me read. Over the years, I have used overlays extensively. I've seen so much improvement, I decided to become certified. The students want the overlays. They want to read. They come up to me years later and ask for them. When they can read with their peers, they mostly quit being behavior problems. Some students I'll ask, are you behaving this way because it's reading time and you can't read? Many have said yes. Thank you for this opportunity, and I welcome any questions you may have. Sincerely, Shelley Moorfield, substitute staff.
Thank you.
My name is Kay McNally, and I'm from Lyons, Oregon, in Marion County. I retired in 2014 after working for 28 years at the Marion County Juvenile Department. And during my final 3 years there, I worked as an education advocate and became an Erlin screener. I've been an Erlin screener now for 5 years, and since retirement, I've offered those services to North Sandyam School District, which is the area I'm in, and also to the people on the Sandyam Canyon Youth Services Team that I a community volunteer with. Some of those, and I talked to the teachers at Mary Lynn School, which is our K through 8 up there, and gave them information because most people don't know about Erlin, but. It's one of those things where you hear about it and then it drops off your radar. So I've volunteered to freely screen the kids up there, and I have done some. And some of them have had Erlin and other ones have not, but that's okay. It's that screening process to find out what might help, because she said it's a non-invasive way to take care of a problem. And if a couple of overlays can help a kid learn how to read, make those words stay on the page and not move around, make the lines in the math go straight, that's a quick fix. And it's otherwise, interventions vary a lot for different kinds of special ed situations. And so if we can go in and start with seeing, is there an Erlin issue, and get that taken care of if it is, and help them out, or if it's not, then move on to something else. It makes sense to me. As the education advocate, I tested many teens. And you know, by that time, they don't think they're readers. They don't think they're really good at school. They don't picture themselves as being really a good student. They've lost that love of reading. And if we could screen kids early so they don't lose that, then that makes the best sense to me. And we can hopefully get kids' questions screened, and our readers with difficulties will get better. We can decrease poor behavior in classrooms and ultimately increase our graduation rate. So thank you for hearing me out today.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Just out of curiosity, your comment with regard to falling off the radar and whatever, what are the overall numbers that we're looking at in terms of the number of kids impacted? I recognize the potential cost savings, and maybe the other individual who testified earlier would have better answer, but we recognize we could save juvenile costs, but we're not going to cut all of the juvenile activity because of Erlin.
Sure.
And I'm wondering how many students would you project would need to go through the test? How many positives would you have? How many false positives, et cetera? What did those numbers look like?
My understanding is about 10 to 12% of the population has Erlin issues. So in a classroom of 30 kids, you'd have about three or four. But that's why when they start to drop off and they get into the juvenile department, the numbers get a lot higher, because they just, you know, that's their job is school. So
yep.
I have something to add to that. Sure. I work in a very low-income community, and my rate is much higher. It's not 15%. It's more like 100% of all of my lowest reading groups, because they give me the lowest reading groups. It's 100%. And then I have found in a classroom, my second grade classroom, I had about half of them on the overlays.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next, we will bring Susan Farmer, because I like to go back and forth, and I think Susan might be not in favor. Is that correct? No, oh, right there.
Thank you.
Yes.
Oh, there it is.
We've also got that already on our OLIS system, but go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Chair Roblin and Senate Committee, on education members. Thank you for this opportunity. I am a licensed teacher specializing in dyslexia. My credentials are listed. I've had a 3-hour semester-long course in diagnosing and remediating dyslexia, which included content regarding Erlen syndrome symptoms and solutions. My testimony opposes Senate Bill 142. I hope, since I'm the only one here doing that, that you will allow me to present the reasons why I am opposed to this. I believe that this is a problematic bill in many ways. I'm going to start with saying that I would like to explain my concerns regarding the concept of Erlen syndrome itself. No doubt this bill sparks interest because of the recent focus on dyslexia legislation. It is important for the committee to know that Erlen philosophy is quite different from what science tells us about dyslexia. Those of us in the field of dyslexia, including Dr. Thomas Beck, the state's dyslexia specialist, are working hard to facilitate accurate and scientific factual knowledge about dyslexia. I'm extremely concerned about the misinformation of dyslexia that the Erlen trainings tell our teachers, or would tell. Today, a staff member at Erlen told me that dyslexia is an umbrella term for any reading problem. That is simply not true. There are very specific characteristics of dyslexia. The Erlen website states, quote, as many as half of the children and adults with perceptual processing problems are misdiagnosed with dyslexia. These individuals can be helped by the Erlen method. If your child has visual dyslexia, the Erlen method can make a difference. This is so misleading. Dyslexia is not a perceptual problem, and it has nothing to do with vision. In other words, if a person gets legitimate dyslexia testing with standardized assessments in reading, phonological processing, and spelling, among others, a misdiagnosis would be extremely rare, if not impossible. The fact is, there is no such thing as what Erlen refers to as visual dyslexia. Multiple scientific studies have confirmed this. I've attached a handout I compiled with research proving that any attempt to diagnose dyslexia with tests of vision is not appropriate. Lest I give the wrong impression, I want to clarify, I do believe in the existence of Erlen syndrome, and I have even referred a few people to Marsha Davis for possible Erlen screening, and I will continue to do so if I suspect that that's a problem. Yet I also believe Erlen is not teaching factual information and could wrongly diagnose students and fail to send dyslexia students to those professionals for a full diagnosis. A huge percent of the questionnaire items which Erlen red flags as symptomatic of Erlen are actually possible symptoms of dyslexia. The long-term questionnaire has so many items on it that it's descriptive of dyslexia, and I did not even attempt to list them. Any responsible person who saw that many items flagged on a questionnaire would refer that person for a full dyslexia evaluation. It's a great concern that Erlen screeners do not have thorough training in the diagnosis of dyslexia and the scientific facts regarding the symptoms. They are totally unable to distinguish between those who have dyslexia and those who might benefit from Erlen. To use Erlen as the first method of helping our vulnerable, failing readers is irresponsible. I have to agree with the American Academy of Pediatrics, which joined other professional organizations, to say about Erlen, and I quote, the expense of such treatment may divert resources from evidence-based reading intervention. In a perfect world, screening would be amazing. What is helpful is not always necessary, and what is necessary is not always the responsibility of the school. Erlen cannot take precedent over first conducting a full vision exam and referring to an ophthalmologist if necessary. Erlen screeners cannot substitute for or take precedent over appropriate dyslexia screening. We currently have teachers grumbling and complaining about doing a 10-minute screening for dyslexia risk factors in our schools. And thus far, that's far more important than Erlen. I do believe that our legislators need to reserve expense and treatment first to recognizing and identifying the presence of dyslexia in a student.
Fairly quickly, because we do have your written testimony.
And proving legitimate scientific remediation. I apologize, there's probably would be a lot more people testifying on this bill were it not for the two dyslexia bills coming up in two more days.
That's right.
I'm happy to entertain questions. I did not address my concern about the training, which is very proprietary. Only people who are certified through one organization in this United States would be allowed to do training for dyslexia, for Erlen, and that concerns me as well.
Thank you very much.
I'm happy to take any questions if you have any.
Any questions? I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
And being a dyslexic person, I do understand there are differences. At the same time, I think that Erlen can help people.
Oh, sometimes. I agree.
So,
I agree.
Okay. Just wanted to make
it's
sure.
It's just where How do my dollars need to be spent right now with so much in the pot?
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Jeff Reiser and Enjin Farr. I guess that's the last two.
Oh, I'm not testifying.
Okay.
I'm Jeff Reiser.
Okay.
On this bill?
Anybody else that needs to speak to Erlen syndrome? I don't think I missed anybody. Okay. Thank you very much. It's okay. We'll get some more testimony. If you have anything else, you can write it and send it to us too. So we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 142, which means that we only have 196 still open. So the following list. And also Lisa Hilgard and Mary Sikora. And Kelly, who else?
Shelly
Olson?
Sheila.
Sorry about that. And thank you guys for staying around. And I appreciate the fact that you gave us time to get the others. Some of our committee people may have other committees they're going to have to go, but we have a few more minutes, and this record will be part of the permanent record. So thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for the extra time also on the opening of SB 196. My name is Lisa Hilliard. I teach machine tool technology, industrial safety, and vocational language teaching for learners of English. Historically, I've also worked for Oregon Graduate Institute, Portland State University, and Portland Community College. Currently, I'm at Mount Hood Community College and at Clackamas Community College. I am proud to be here in support of SB 196 in association with the Oregon Education Association. I'd like to share my personal experience to illustrate the need for this legislation. Being underinsured affects me like all other employees. I delay medical care in the hopes that my ailment will work itself out in time. This means that I go to work at less than 100% wellness from time to time. The inequity in my status as a part-time instructor is highlighted. I have the same advanced degrees as my full-time counterparts and lack the availability to health insurance coverage highlights the disparity between me and my full-time counterparts. They have access to whatever medical service they personally need, and I do not. Since I am eligible for PERS with a combination of state work sites, I am confused why the state cannot also apply the same sense and system to derive a further benefit and recognition of the work that part-time faculty offer. I am in the machine tool world, and I am very interested in continuous improvement processes. And as CIP is coming into both the education sectors and hopefully into the governmental factors, I would just say that we already have a system in place that's counting my FTE. And I think we would be able to expand upon that. And it's just a simple amplification of a quality system that we're already doing, and we should be able to account for how much FTE I'm working across the various institutions I work at variously. Historically, health insurance was inaccessible to me. In fact, historically, I used to be able to write off my mileage between the community colleges I worked at, but the tax system changed. So now I don't even get a write-off for being able to work at several community colleges. Several years ago, Mount Hood Community College allowed OEBB as an option, And that's really expensive, too. I would just say, in conclusion, that I am also of that population that suffers under the Affordable Health Care Act because I am not eligible for subsidies and I have to pay a higher deductible than other plans that may be available to me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Not sure if I'll need this.
It's for us.
Okay. My name is Mary Sikora, Chair Roblin and members of the Senate Education Committee. I speak for myself today and also for the thousands of Oregonian adjunct faculty who can't be here today. I began as an adjunct instructor of German at Portland State University in February 2010, but I quickly learned that as an adjunct, that was as far as I was going to ever get. I would never teach more than 0.49 FTE at one institution. I would never receive health care at Portland State, and at Portland State specifically, I wouldn't even receive the 6% PERS contribution. It was up to me to make that out of my own earnings. There is something fundamentally demoralizing when you realize that the reason you're being held to 0.49 FTE at the public institution that you're teaching at is because your employer is balancing their budget by depriving you and 65% of the part-time faculty who serve future Oregonians by seeing us as a cost-saving measure. Because I soon learned that my employer didn't care, I decided to go to the group that did, and I became involved in my faculty, part-time faculty union. I vowed from that day forward that I would not stop until all part-time faculty, not just at Portland State, but all community colleges and state universities, until we all had access to health care. This has not come at little cost. Because of my involvement in the union, being on the bargaining team of our contract negotiations and speaking out for better faculty situations at my university, I was offered no classes this fall. I was told that there had been program changes when we all knew that that wasn't actually true, and I could see that the class I was supposed to teach was actually TBA. But this won't stop me just because they don't want to give voice to this concern. I don't have my job, but fortunately I became involved in another very politically active faculty union, and I'm still here today. I'm not going to quit, and I'm not going to be silenced. We are the new faculty majority. We are 65% of highly qualified PhD'd and mastered faculty and researchers across the state who are teaching the next generation of Oregonians to be critical thinkers and engaged citizens. I ask you today that as we demonstrate our commitment to our students every day in the classroom, please demonstrate your commitment to us and say yes to Senate Bill 196, and please say yes to health care for part-time faculty. Thank you.
Thank you. And before we go on to the next one, I am going, and it is, it's juice, right? For German. Okay, okay, German.
He's talking. Oh, me. Oh, I'm sorry.
German faculty, right?
So German faculty, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Is it Tschüss as you say goodbye to someone?
Tschüss, yes.
Just wanted to say.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Auf Wiedersehen. I know Auf Wiedersehen, but yes. Sometimes it sounds a little sarcastic, so I like Tschüss better when I was over there. So thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here. We are going to, the two work sessions we have, are we're going to reschedule them on a different date. We had amendments that didn't make it, so in the conversation it didn't happen. So the two, those are not going to be here. So thank you both, and we will invite up. Is it Kristen Fink, Aaron Q. Long, and
Enrique Ferrara?
Enrique Ferrara.
Kristen had the small children. She had to leave.
Okay. So
Enrique,
Aaron, and Andrea Henderson?
Andrea already testified.
Andrea already spoke. That's right.
On the other bill. Okay.
And
Magdalene
Powers? So any of those people want to come and speak, and anybody who hasn't been called that would like to speak, you're welcome to come on up. Yeah.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Enrique Ferrer, and I'm an academic advisor at Clackamas Community College, and I'm here in support of the bill because of healthcare benefits for part-time faculty, because as an academic advisor, students want consistency. And as we heard earlier, part-time faculty don't have the stability to provide healthcare for their family members. In addition, they have to bounce around different campuses, which it affects the academic learning of the students, but in addition, the academic culture at the college. I'm also here to reassure that the faculty are teaching and influencing the future Oregonians, but we're lying to them when we say to them that education is the future, when they're struggling themselves to have a decent future, to educate the future educators, the future bankers, future senators. So I'll encourage you to support the bill. But in addition to that, there's other members of the faculty or the associations within the colleges and universities who teach part-time and don't receive the benefits, and they have to add additional jobs in the private sector who also don't have the benefits that will allow them to provide for their families. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you. So is there anyone else that would like to speak to this bill that hasn't had an opportunity? Okay. Well, then I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 196. Thank you all for coming and sharing your stories. I know it isn't always easy to do that, and it is the process we have to try to get people here and have a conversation so that we can decide how best to move it. This is a bill that does have cost. Therefore, if it comes out of this committee, it goes to Ways and Means. And then it gets to wait there for a while until we figure out what we're going to do and how much revenue we have. So speaking just for myself, I think it is a great conversation. We've had it for the last few years, actually. So I appreciate the persistence that people have with this one. And I thank people for all of the conversations that we've had today about a number of different issues that are really important in education. So with that, anything else that you... Nope. I'm going to close the Senate Education Committee on this date, March 28th, 2017. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.